The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Monday, November 21st, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. An administration in transition and a country in transition. As President-elect Donald Trump works to fill his cabinet and to make sure that speculation and drama and attention is part of the process. But first, in the aftermath of 9/11, the Bush administration implemented something called NSEERS. That's the National Security Entry Exit Registration System. That program ran from 2002 until 2011, and under it, certain foreign citizens and nationals within the U.S. had to go to immigration offices for fingerprinting or photos and interviews, and then participate in periodic check-ins. Those certain individuals were not random. The rules apply to people on non-immigrant visas, men over the age of 16, and those from countries that the Bush administration defined as havens for terrorists. 24 of the 25 countries on that list were majority Muslim countries, and inevitably, Muslims were targeted as a result. Then, after numerous court challenges and complaints from Muslim groups, NSEERS was finally dropped in 2011. Now, Donald Trump appears to be considering bringing that program back, or something like it, after running a campaign rife with Islamophobic sentiment, from the temporary ban on Muslims to the extreme vetting that he described in the campaign.
We'll be perfectly honest. It is legal. They say it'll hold constitutional muster. I know the ACLU is going to challenge it, but I think it'll pass. And we've done it with Iran back a while ago. We did it during World War II with Japanese, which, you know, call what you
Come
will,
on.
maybe
you're
wrong.
Not, but you're not proposing we go back to the days of internment camps, I hope.
No. I'm not proposing that at all, Megan.
That's Megyn Kelly talking to Trump supporter Carl Higbee, a former Navy SEAL and spokesperson for the pro-Trump Great American PAC, endorsing the idea of a Muslim registry suggested by Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach last week. Kobach is advising the Trump transition on immigration policy, and Donald Trump's future White House Chief of Staff, Reince Priebus, refused to denounce the idea on Sunday's Meet the Press program with Chuck Todd on NBC.
Can you equivocally rule out a registry for Muslims?
Look, I'm not going to rule out anything, but I wouldn't. We're not going to have a registry based on a religion. But what I think what we're trying to do is say that there are some people, certainly not all people, Chuck. Mm-hmm. There are some people that are radicalized, and there are some people that have to be prevented from coming into this country.
In addition to the possible return of a registry that would focus even indirectly on Muslims, the Trump transition also appears intent to ban immigration from many predominantly Muslim countries. Now, it may not come as a surprise that hate crimes against Muslims spiked last year to the highest level in more than a decade. And now, Muslim and Jewish faith leaders are being forced to reckon with a new reality that seems a lot more like America 50 years ago than it does 2016. Joining me now is Rabbi David Fox Sandmel. He's the Anti-Defamation League's Director of Interreligious Engagement. And also Manaz Afridi. She's Assistant Professor of Religious Studies and Director of the Holocaust, Genocide, and Interfaith Education Center at Manhattan College. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Manaz Afridi, first, this registry, do you interpret it as a registry of Muslims? What message do you think this is sending to Americans?
Well, you know, I mean, the message is rhetorical, and there's a lot of fear in the Muslim community. There's a lot of confusion. We've experienced Islamophobia since 9/11. It's not a new sentiment in the United States, but at the same time, it's very fearful. I mean, for example, my own child is scared that I'm going to get deported because one of the countries that's listed is Pakistan. And I'm from Pakistan. However, I'm a U.S. citizen, abiding citizen, and actually peacemaker in the United States.
Rabbi Sandmel, government lists based on religion are a thing that immediately get the attention of a lot of Jews.
This is something that the Jewish community has experienced in Nazi Germany. And it, of course, raises concerns. I don't want to go to the point of drawing analogies between the 1930s and today. There are lots of differences. But on an emotional level, when we hear these sort of things, it certainly raises concerns. And the Manaz was speaking about her daughter. I've had conversations with a number of Muslim colleagues who have told almost the exact same story about their children. And when I think about children's sense of security being shaken in that way, I find that very distressing and disheartening.
It's interesting with both of you, as soon as I asked about this proposed policy, neither of your answers had much to do with policy. This is a rhetorical problem and a cultural problem that seems to reach back to the campaign and now into the transition with Donald Trump himself and now his surrogates drawing bright lines between groups of people and engaging in rhetoric that seems to set Muslims apart as an other, quite apart from whether such a registry would be effective.
Let me just say, I educate students, young, very bright students at Manhattan College, and I run a center, and I teach Islam, and I teach the Holocaust. So I deal with both Islamophobia and anti-Semitism. So one of the things that I have understood as a scholar and as a Muslim American is that rhetoric, mythologizing of the other, is a very deep problem in our culture. I would implore people and politicians to watch out for rhetoric that causes fear amongst groups and has caused more Islamophobia and anti-Semitism in the last week or so.
Rabbi Sandmel, one of the observations in the last week or two during the transition, you've seen people online counting the number of tweets and statements, for instance, that Donald Trump has made about Hamilton the musical or about other various things in the culture. But none of those were denouncing any of the public displays of Islamophobia or anti-Semitism that we've seen around the country.
Well, I think one of the roles of our leaders, this is all our leaders, our government leaders, religious leaders, is to send the right message to all the citizens of our country. And so one of my concerns here is that while I think there is probably a distinction between the positions of President-elect Trump and some of those who support him, the fact that he has not been clearer in his denunciation of this kind of both rhetoric and action gives me pause.
Minaz Afridi, there's something to reckon with here as we've talked about the rhetoric that Donald Trump and his surrogates have used. Millions and millions of people voted for this candidate, internalizing the rhetoric that he used or simply ignoring it, saying they're in a way that they're fine with it because they support some other aspect of the program. And we have to reckon with the attitudes that tens of millions of Americans seem to have about their fellow Muslim Americans.
Yeah, I mean, look, if people supported Trump, I don't have a problem with them. They're human beings. They're citizens. They had all kinds of reasons to support Trump. And I stand equally with them as an American. But the whole idea of fear is also not mentioned. A lot of people in the United States are fearful of Muslims. They're fearful of ISIS. They're fearful of Al-Qaeda. They're fearful of Boko Haram. A very small percentage of my people are extremists. Very small percentage of my people are going to cause the extremism that, you know, the fear is played on. However, what's really interesting to me is that since 9/11, there has been so many misunderstandings about Islam. And you would think that after 9/11, we would go out and we'd really find out who these 1.6 billion people are. But we still haven't done our homework. And it's challenging and it's frustrating for me. I mean, I know we certainly haven't done our homework for anti-Semitism. I teach the Holocaust. So here I am, you know, faced with a new reality, so dealing with two others in the United States. But I also want to say that we as people will not let hard-lined policies that are racist, that are blatantly against a group of people, come into being. I believe in this administration, and I believe in the next administration, that we as Americans are going to come together with alliances like the Jews and Muslims and others to stop these policies. And I really believe in the people of the United States.
Let's talk about action for a second. Jonathan Greenblatt is the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, your organization. He went on television and said that if there is any kind of Muslim registry in this country, that Jonathan Greenblatt would register as a Muslim. Will you do the same?
Absolutely. I think that the message that sends is any action, any law that curtails the rights of any particular individual or any particular group affects all of us.
Is that heartening, Manaza Pretty?
Yes, absolutely. I want to just say a few things about action. There's a lot of really good work being done between Jews and Muslims, and I don't think the public really knows how hard we work together. They only see the trouble in the Middle East. And this is the rhetoric that should be out there. This good work, this community organizing should be out there. Why are we fixated on negativity and fear?
But
this
I want to interrupt you because talk about the importance of this alternative rhetoric. It's nice to hold hands. It's nice to be nice. Interfaith dialogue is nice. There's a strategic imperative here, which is the more that the government can get people from these different groups to cooperate, the easier it is to prevent the people who are extremists from engaging in terrorism. It's easier to catch people if more people cooperate, if you have more eyes and ears.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm going to a little critique with your language. Catch people. That kind of language is, you know, it's kind of offensive to Muslims or Jews. I mean, who are you catching? What are you catching for? Under former President Bush, we also had a policy that vetted Muslims. So, I mean, is that the policy or what is the registry about? I mean, to say that all Muslims have to register or there are 7 or 8 countries where people come move back and forth is a whole different story. And I want some clarity on that. Now, I want to also talk about this feel good. You know, sitting with Jews and Muslims is not a feel good thing, especially when you're challenged with issues of Israel, when you're challenged with issues of Palestine, when you're challenged with issues of extremism. So the work that we're doing is challenging. It's not feel good. We don't just have interfaith dinners and walk out. We have really hard conversations and challenges. But we also share one thing, and that is the dream of being American and living here and showing to our children, that's so important, that Jews, Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, anyone else, Zoroastrians, Hindus, atheists even, are all human beings. And we live here and share this dream together. And I think that if you want to talk about feel good, well, certainly people are not feeling good. So I guess that's been accomplished by the rhetoric today by the politicians.
Rabbi?
I would second what my colleague has said, and I would add to it that one of the challenges I think we have in this country is that people don't know one another. And what we have found is that when people have the opportunity to sit down with and get to know someone whom they have identified as other, and they're able to put a human face on that person, a name on that person, to hear about their experiences, that can change attitudes. We've seen that in a number of issues in our country. I would say same-sex marriage is one of those issues. And so I also would not downplay the importance of people simply talking and getting to know one another. If it stops there, then it hasn't fulfilled its potential.
Rabbi David Fox Sandmel is the Anti-Defamation League's Director of Interreligious Engagement. And Menaz Afridi is Assistant Professor of Religious Studies and Director of the Holocaust, Genocide, and Interfaith Education Center at Manhattan College. Thanks to you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Getting the Affordable Care Act up and running was one of the biggest challenges and accomplishments of the Obama administration. President-elect Donald Trump vowed completely to repeal Obamacare during the campaign, however, and has since said he would consider a plan that keeps in place some provisions. But Republicans on Capitol Hill have voted dozens of times to weaken or repeal Obamacare. And now, with majorities in Congress and a Republican president, they have the votes to do it. Still, an estimated 100,000 people rushed to sign up for Obamacare the day after the election a few weeks ago. And record numbers are expected to join before the enrollment period ends in January. With repeal coming, the bigger question is what will this mean for millions of Americans who couldn't get insurance before the ACA and how Republicans will replace it if they get rid of it. Sylvia Matthews-Burwell is Secretary of Health and Human Services. She says consumers need to realize what's at stake.
The reality is that 20 million Americans have health insurance because of the Affordable Care Act. The reality is over 120 million Americans have pre-existing conditions that if you repeal the Affordable Care Act, your ability to get health insurance can go away. For many Americans, their children are on their plan up to 26. And for most Americans, they think it's a good idea and don't want to go back to a world where they have to pay for certain preventative care, things like pre-cancer screenings, vaccinations, wellness visits for your children. These are the benefits that are across the entire population.
President-elect Trump himself has suggested there may be parts of this that people like, but he's not the first. There have been Republicans throughout this debate who have acknowledged the very popular parts of Obamacare. So then the question becomes, what does replace look like? And I know you don't get a vote, but if Republicans who are now going to be running the show want to keep something that people like, for instance, the idea that you can't be denied for a pre-existing condition, what does the insurance reality, the policy reality look like if they're going to get rid of the idea that you have to have insurance?
The reality is that unless you offer help or assistance, the subsidies that exist, the tax credits that exist, there isn't a way to take care of pre-existing conditions. And I think that's one of the things when I say the reality needs to set in, that there are pieces of this that are interconnected and you can't have one without the other. Someone mentioned to me the game Jenga the other day, and when you pull one piece out, the tower falls. And so if you select what you want to keep, by selecting that, you're actually selecting many other pieces and parts. And I think it's, from our perspective, important to focus on, we've stated there are improvements that can be made. And when we think about improvements or when we think about replacement, I think the standard that the American people should use is a standard of, what does it do to access, the number of people insured? What does it do to affordability, what it costs for people to pay for their insurance, and what it costs the American taxpayer? And third, what does it do for quality? I think for many Americans, and many women certainly, the question of, is contraception covered without an additional copay, isn't a nitty-gritty detail. It's an important fact that they want to know in terms of their coverage.
The new president ran explicitly on an agenda of repeal. Republicans now do have the votes to repeal, regardless of what they do to replace. This can't be an easy time.
You know, I think the assumption of disintegration, the assumption that all this is going away, this is in the fabric of the nation. The American people accept, if you ask anyone now, is it okay to keep you off your health insurance if you have asthma, if you have allergies, if you have diabetes, if you know someone who's had cancer? The answer to that is no. And it's a complicated system. When you said that this was a triumph for Democrats, it was a triumph for the nation. Go back to Teddy Roosevelt over 100 years ago in our nation, and you'll see him talking about the issue of universal access to health care in our country. Go through president after president, Republican and Democrats.
I appreciate the fabric statement, but this could have gone a different way, and it's not the way that so many people had hoped. I mean, Republicans do have the votes, whether it's politically smart or not, whether they want to pull the thread on the fabric or not, they do have the votes to repeal this, and it is their project.
In leading the department and the effort that we are leading, you know, what is my job and my role is to focus on what we do and what we can do. And right now, the most important thing for us is to make sure that we have a successful open enrollment, build on the success and the progress we've made in terms of reducing the number of uninsured, and make sure as many people as possible start that movement from the rhetoric to the reality of what this means and how this works. So many people use it as a shorthand. And when people say Obamacare, but then you ask them the specific questions, up to 26, pre-existing conditions, help and financial assistance for working Americans to get their coverage and pay their premiums. These are not things that people want to go away. As a matter of fact, people perhaps need more premium assistance. We're working on short-term solutions to cost in the system and long-term solutions. And here at HHS, we've committed that Medicare payments, 30%, will be made on not fee for service, but for the quality of service. And we are moving so that by 2018, 50% of those will be that way.
You stepped up to the plate for one last slogan, since you're knocking down slogans today, voucher. And the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, talking about long-term projects, has a long-term project to transform Medicare to premium support. He also has the votes to do that and has already made signals that in the new Congress, in addition to all of these changes about Obamacare repeal that we've been talking about, that Medicare may fundamentally change and may change into a program where seniors are given a certain amount of money and then sent onto the marketplace. That's the Ryan vision, and he has the votes to do it.
You know, it's interesting. That's a vision that's the same as the marketplace for others. That is what the marketplace is. I think the question of changing Medicare fundamentally, 50 years ago when the program was designed, it was designed to make sure that we provide financial and health security for our seniors in this country. To take that away is something that I think will be highly concerning to the American people.
Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. It seemed like nearly everyone on the internet and on cable news were preoccupied with condemning President-elect Donald Trump's latest Twitter tantrum, this time directed at the cast of the hit Broadway musical Hamilton for their protest over the weekend. Well, if Donald Trump is happy to have everyone focused on his spat with the New York elite, it might be because elsewhere new details continue to emerge on possible conflicts of interest involving Trump and his commercial enterprises, in addition to the fact that the incoming president has agreed to pay $25 million to settle a suit against him for fraud in the Trump University case. So far, Trump's actions this week, such as meeting with Indian business leaders, suggest a president-elect who is still very much immersed in his personal real estate interests. All of this in addition to new reporting in the Washington Post on Donald Trump's business holdings in Turkey and a Post report that Trump registered 8 companies in Saudi Arabia during the presidential campaign. With me now is Eric Lipton. He's investigative reporter for the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. He's been following the president-elect's business dealings during this transition. Eric Lipton, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
First, let's talk about a meeting that Indian business leaders who are building Trump-branded apartment buildings in India had here in the United States just a couple of days ago.
Right. So this was last Tuesday, and Trump is busy working in his transition, is working with his kids who are also a part of the transition. And during that period, he took a pause to meet with 3 executives from India who had flown in. In part, certainly this was to congratulate him because they just built 2 towers in this town of Pune in western India, which is a luxury apartment building. And they were there to congratulate him, but also, according to sort of reports that they gave, to talk about future developments that they wanted to do with the Trump brand. Trump is doing more in India right now than any place outside of North America. He's got 5 different projects underway. And so it just, you know, is already sort of puts on the map that at the same time as he's preparing for the presidential transition, he and his children are still quite engaged in their business dealings in places all over the world.
All over the world, including right on Pennsylvania Avenue, just blocks from the White House. Around the same time that you're reporting on, Eric Lipton, there was a seminar or a marketing seminar for foreign diplomats in the Trump International Hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, urging them to stay in the hotel, presumably while they're doing business with the U.S. government under Donald Trump.
This is really sort of an unprecedented situation. So here you have the Trump Organization pitching to foreign diplomats, urging them to stay in his hotel a few blocks from the White House. And of course, if they want to try to impress, you know, the president of the United States, they're going to are not offend him. They're going to want to stay in his hotel. I mean, that same building is owned by the General Services Administration, which is an agency of the United States federal government. Donald Trump appoints the head of the GSA, and therefore he is the tenant in that building, and his company is the tenant. So he's going to appoint the head of the agency that he rents from. You know, everywhere you look, up and down the city and across the world, there are places where there's potential conflicts.
In addition to Donald Trump's other businesses, his children going to run his business, which can't be a traditional blind trust. He knows what buildings he owns. He knows where his golf courses are and what countries they're in. This is just a many, many tendriled hydra at this point.
It is. And it's full employment for reporters because they the stories are, you know, everywhere you look. Here you have agreement between the Wall Street Journal editorial page and President Obama. The Journal on Friday wrote an editorial saying Trump's only choice, and this is sounds pretty radical, but it's to liquidate his holdings and to put them into cash and then our treasury bonds or something, and to let a have a true blind trust in which some investment manager runs all of his wealth until he leaves office. Then President Obama was asked yesterday about, you know, what he did, and he said he liquidated. And he said, of course, he had much smaller assets, so it was much less complicated, but that he said he felt free after liquidating to make decisions and to know that no one was going to call him for suggesting that it was a conflict of interest. I don't know what Trump, what choice Trump faces other than that, which is very radical, and I can't imagine he would ever agree to it. But that's, you know, you have the Wall Street Journal and President Obama's urging that on him in recent days.
Eric Lipton, investigative reporter for the Washington Bureau of the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
President-elect Donald Trump campaigned on being the only person who could defeat ISIS.
We are going to defeat the barbarians of ISIS, and we're going to defeat them fast.
That was back in July during his acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention. And since then, Donald Trump has repeated his claim to know more than U.S. generals about how to defeat ISIS. But when Donald Trump was elected president, social media sites associated with ISIS and al-Qaeda celebrated his victory, quote, rejoice with the support from Allah and find glad tidings in the imminent demise of America at the hands of Trump, end quote. That's from one ISIS-related media outlet. Rukmini Callimachi is a correspondent for our partner in the New York Times, reporting on al-Qaeda and ISIS.
Since the election of Donald Trump, both al-Qaeda and the Islamic State have spoken about how Donald Trump essentially helps advance their vision, not because, in their view, he's any different from the Democratic candidate, but because, in their view, he is making explicit the war on Islam. So they go to lengths to explain that both Hillary Clinton and President Obama, and now Donald Trump, are in fact in a war with Islam. They don't believe that we are fighting terrorism. They believe that we are fighting their faith. And the difference they see is that Donald Trump is making that goal explicit. He's talking about it directly, and that helps them in their recruitment efforts because then they can explain to moderate Muslims around the world, see, the American administration hates Muslims.
So this charge in the campaign, such as it was, that the type of rhetoric that Donald Trump was trafficking in really seems to have currency with real terrorists, that they're getting the kind of confrontation on the world stage that they crave.
Yes, but I think we should be careful, Todd. I don't know that the terror threat would be any less if Hillary Clinton had won. This is a group for which there is no middle ground. To them, there are only two camps, the camp of ISIS and the camp of the infidel, and there's nothing in between. So even if the Democrats had won, I think that this would be a group that would still be fighting us.
Does the appointment of Michael Flynn as Donald Trump's national security advisor tell us anything more? Flynn, of course, was the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency for a time in both the Bush and Obama administrations. He was pushed out. He has a decidedly hawkish view towards not only terrorists, but has been known on social media to tweet Islamophobic things. Are we informed at all by that?
There's been no comment at all on any of the ISIS channels that I follow, and I follow several dozen, regarding Mike Flynn's appointment. All we can say is based on what we know of General Flynn. So when he was inside the Obama administration, one of the narratives around him is that he was one of the few people who aggressively argued that ISIS was an imminent threat and that he felt silenced within the administration and essentially was pushed out because he did not want to toe the party line. Of course, the other argument is that he was pushed out because he was a bad manager. I don't know what the truth of it is, but we can certainly expect that Flynn will possibly have a more aggressive approach to fighting ISIS than we've seen before. Now, Will that succeed or will that backfire? I think it's too early to tell.
Some months ago over the summer, ISIS's own magazine called Dabiq published an article that said, "Why We Hate You and Why We Fight You." And reason number one, in ISIS's own words, was, "We hate you first and foremost because you are disbelievers. You reject the oneness of Allah." A purely religious message, not because of politics, not because of U.S. troops in Muslim lands, not because of economics. Those things were way, way, way down the list, if on the list at all. How well do Americans understand what ISIS really wants?
I think Americans overall don't understand ISIS at all. I think that the level of understanding of this group is sadly quite low in light of the fact that we've been fighting them for more than 2 years now. As you point out, their number one objection to us is a religious objection, that we are disbelievers, we are infidels, we are not one with their faith. And I think that where I agree with General Flynn is that it is important to correctly identify the enemy and to correctly identify the enemy's ideology. Without us doing so, we kind of spin our wheels, you know, trying to find a way to defeat them.
Rukmini Kalamaki, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Rukmini Kalamaki is correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Last week, Admiral Michael Rogers, director of the National Security Agency, said that, quote, a nation state very purposefully meddled in the U.S. election with the hope of changing the outcome. He was referring to the Russian government. The intelligence community also learned last week that President-elect Trump is considering plans to dismantle the office of the director of national intelligence and rearrange the U.S. intelligence community. Joining me now to discuss how the intelligence community is responding to Russian meddling and preparing for a Trump presidency is General Michael Hayden. He's former director of the National Security Agency between 1999 and 2005 and director of the CIA between 2006 and 2009. Michael Hayden, welcome.
Hi, Todd.
Well, we just heard a minute ago about Mike Flynn, the former chief of the Defense Intelligence Agency, someone who you know well. He'll be the new national security advisor in the White House. Flynn has shocked a lot of people in your community, General, with his rhetoric, his outspoken political leanings in the campaign, leading chants of lock her up, retweeting anti-Islamic tweets. What do you think about his appointment in the White House, and what does it tell us about the direction of the Trump administration?
Sure, Todd. About two or three thoughts. Number one, Mike brings to the job certain strengths, a career in intelligence, unarguable tactical and operational success in the armed forces. Now he's got to stretch his game. This is a global strategic level job. Secondly, Mike has a lot of ideas, but unless you're hiring a Kissinger or Brzezinski or a Scowcroft to be national security advisor, what you really want in the job is a process guy, a guy who makes sure all the parts of the government have a chance to express their views before the president makes a decision. And that's going to challenge Mike as well. And then finally, Todd, I mean, I think it's fair to say that the candidate Trump has been a bit intemperate, at least in his language, during the campaign. And so I would like a national security advisor who would balance that. I'm not sure instinctively that Mike is that guy because he's had his own comments during the campaign.
Admiral Mike Rogers is your successor at the NSA. He's very publicly said that a foreign state had meddled in the election with the expectation of affecting the outcome. Him saying that publicly seemed like a signal. How heavy is the appetite in the intelligence community for a more public airing of an investigation into Russian hacking intended to help swing the election?
That's a very difficult decision for the intelligence community, Todd. On the one hand, you do want the world to know what these people did. We've only dimed out a foreign actor twice in my memory, the North Koreans against Sony North America, and now the Russians against the Democrat National Committee. So we do that reluctantly because we don't want to reveal sources and methods. But in this case, I think the consensus in the community is to point out to our citizens and to the world what the Russians have done, a cyber attack, the theft of information, which I'm on record, Todd, as saying that's kind of honorable international espionage. But then to take the information, wash it through WikiLeaks, and use it to influence the American political process, that's something different.
So does Mike Rogers saying this publicly into a microphone send a signal that he and other leaders in the intel community want this taken more seriously?
Well, I think it sends a signal that they are confident in their conclusions, that the Russians did do this. And prior to Mike Rogers saying this, Jim Clapper said it about 2 or 3 weeks ago, that this indeed was done by on behalf of the Russian state. So Mike saying it, Mike Rogers, is simply kind of adding an exclamation point to what's already been put out there by the government and by the American intelligence community. And again, Todd, I got to tell you, with high confidence, they're, it doesn't get any better than that in making an intelligence assessment. So we believe firmly the Russians did this.
It is a time of huge change. It appears to be a time of huge change coming for the intelligence community, General Hayden. Mike Rogers himself is under what appears to be intense pressure from the White House. There are people within the White House who have signaled that it's time for him to go because of what they see as incompetence in terms of NSA security. Whether or not he keeps his job in the short term, you also have a President-elect Trump who is toying with the idea of reordering at least the bureaucratic infrastructure of the intelligence community, getting rid of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. There's definitely a time of turmoil here. I know these things are always much more different on the inside than they appear to be from the outside, but what's your assessment?
Well, number one, back in the day, 2004, I wasn't a fan of creating the Director of National Intelligence, although I became the first principal deputy director of the DNI. But this system can work, Todd. You put the right people in the jobs. The DNI structure is an effective structure with the right people and with the support of the president. So I just don't think the American intelligence community needs another major restructuring. So I would push that aside. Now, in addition to that, something really interesting is happening here, Todd. We've already talked about Mike Flynn becoming the National Security Advisor. Now Mike Rogers is talked about as being the potential Director of National Intelligence. Now, if you believe the press accounts, here are two officers, one who left and one who might leave the intelligence community of this administration under unhappy circumstances, being selected by the follow-on administration for key leadership roles. What that tells me, Todd, is that the hyper-partisanship in Washington now has bled over into the American intelligence and security community, and that can't be good news. And Todd, I'm not making any comments on the merits of the case in either officer's case, but the fact that this is happening should be troubling to all serious Americans.
It also appears then that the hyperpartisanship that you're talking about, General, not only has bled over into the intel community, but in their new leaders who might be going for just political opposites instead of other choices.
Well, you're talking about the nominee to be director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Congressman Pompeo. Actually, I mean, he certainly was political as a Republican in Congress, but while he was doing that, he was also a careful student of intelligence. The agency had a lot of time for him. He asked serious questions and wanted to learn. So I think, on balance, the American intelligence community is quite happy with that choice.
Big changes, some turmoil, and a potential reordering of the structure of the U.S. intelligence community. We're going to talk a lot more about this before Donald Trump takes office on January 20th. General Michael Hayden, former director of the NSA and the CIA. Thanks as always, General.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Earlier this month, officials in Vietnam crushed and burned more than $7 million in ivory and rhino horn. It was all part of an effort to deter the black market sale of ivory and try to devalue those tusks. Still, demand hasn't subsided. Between 2010 and 2012, an estimated 100,000 elephants were killed illegally. And according to the David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust, an elephant is killed for its tusks every 15 minutes. A single pound of ivory can fetch $1,500 on the black market, sometimes more. And most of that market is in China. A new film from executive producer Leonardo DiCaprio called The Ivory Game depicts the underbelly of ivory trafficking. It's a dramatic new documentary. It goes undercover in Africa and China into the lives and activities of intelligence operatives, undercover activists, and frontline rangers. Directors Keith Davidson and Richard Lonkani say the poaching isn't isolated to specific countries in East Africa. Poachers are moving their way westward toward Tanzania and other countries as well.
Yeah, it's actually like a whole wave. Like Central Africa is hardest hit. Like we've lost up to 80-90% of populations in Central Africa. when we started filming, the wave was going through East Africa, Kenya and Tanzania, moving south. That was what we were following around, watching them fight back with everything they had. But as we progressed in the filming, the poachers started moving towards Southern Africa, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Botswana. So what we're seeing is a big circular wave that is just kind of wiping out the elephants.
Keith, we're basically talking about China here, right, as the market, effectively. Is that right?
Correct.
How big is the illicit market in China? And describe that, because part of the market is legal, mm-hmm. most of it's illegal, and that's where a lot of the loopholes in black market comes into play here.
Yeah, I mean, there's 95% of the ivory that's killed, elephants killed, ultimately make their way through China specifically. So there's still a huge, huge demand for ivory. Not everyone knows this, but ivory is mainly used for art. It's a status symbol. So intricate carvings, and this is, has been going on for generations. It's really a status symbol of the wealthy, the upper class. But, it's a problem that we do see some hope in. There's been some, drastic developments this year. China has said that they will ban ivory. They just haven't given a date yet. And until a date is given, then there's a lot of unknowns.
Now, one of the characters, Richard, in your story is a young man named Hong, who's Chinese. Kind of a remarkable character in your story. One of the people, as Keith describes, a young person in China who sees something wrong in this situation. Who is Hong?
Hong is just this amazing character that we found very early on in the production. And he was just starting out to become an investigator, and he wanted to make a difference. So when we met him, he hadn't been involved in any dangerous operations, but he volunteered to this other guy that we met who was running a lot of operations across Africa to fight poachers and traffickers. And he needed someone like Hong, a Chinese who was willing to go meet dangerous criminals, traffickers who were also dealing with drugs and arms trade, and pose as a buyer so that they could arrest these people. So Hong for us was amazing because he's Chinese and he stands for all these Chinese that we point our fingers at and say, you're bad people. But he says, look, I'm Chinese and I'm fighting this and I'm risking my life and I want the world to see that Chinese are also fighting back.
Local criminals, they seldom suspect me because unfortunately, they just never imagine like a Chinese could be on the right side of the ivory and rhino home battle. So I realized, oh, this time I can make some difference. I can be part of the change makers.
For us, it was amazing to watch him over the course of 1.5 years progress and become this like fearless, amazing investigator that brought unbelievable evidence to the film, but also for the cause of high-level traffickers being involved, even government being involved.
Part of the backdrop, Richard, of this film, of course, are humans destroying elephants, but then also battles between different factions of humans, those trying to protect the elephants. There are local farmers who just want to protect their families and their crops, and elephants might trample them. Of course, there are international poachers. There are governments. Not all of the humans are on the same side. And I wonder if you got any sense or if any of your subjects had the sense that elephants have a sense that some humans are on their side, many humans are a mortal threat.
Yeah, I mean, they're very intelligent and they understand who's approaching them. Like, for example, when you approach an elephant in a car that the elephant doesn't know, he will be very fearful and also aggressive towards that car. They recognize you from miles away. They can smell you. So, it really depends who's getting close to them. And the village people that hate elephants are the ones that are affected by crop raiding. When the elephants come in and eat all their supplies like watermelons and potatoes and corn, and they hate them because they take away their livelihoods.
You look at any one of those people and you know they could kill an elephant for sure. And killing an elephant is a real short step to becoming a full-blown poacher. Someone shot an elephant over there and they thought they saw one and they run to go and kill it.
You guys ready to run? We've got to catch before they cross the road. Follow me. Keep coming.
We also need to look at the broader picture and fencing and all these solutions that come after we can stop the poaching. What do we do with these elephants roaming the wild and approaching villages?
There are many scenes in your film where the undercover footage is in boutique retail ivory shops in China, in Beijing or Hong Kong, all over China, hundreds of them. Why isn't the Chinese government raiding these shops, confiscating the inventory and publicly burning it?
Ivory was technically banned in 89. So the problem is there's a lot of shops that are doing very illegal things. They have certificates with the amount of, you know, they have a certain number of tons of ivory that they're allowed to sell. But what they're doing is that they're mixing illegal ivory with the supposed legal ivory. Right now, we're at a crucial moment. And this film really is the most urgent film that we've done, because we're at this point where China, since they have said we will ban the ivory trade, you know, the message needs to get out there, and they need to ban it, and they need to ban it quickly. Because if they say, like Hong Kong did, there was another thing that happened this year. Hong Kong said, we're going to ban ivory in 5 years. 5 years from now, half the elephant population will be gone. So China needs to come forth and say, we're going to ban it, and we're going to ban it immediately.
The film The Ivory Game comes out at a moment of urgency for the population of African elephants, as tons and tons of ivory still pour out of Central and Southern Africa towards China. Richard Lalkani and Keith Davidson are the directors of The Ivory Game. Gentlemen, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The Ivory Game is available now on Netflix. So how do those illegal traffickers get the word of their illegal products out to the world? A new investigation by the Wildlife Justice Commission found that Facebook is the primary medium used by traders to sell their goods across Southeast Asia. Potential buyers can make bids for bracelets made of ivory for as little as $20. And payments are usually processed through the WeChat wallet app. Facebook says, we do not allow the sale and trade of endangered animals, and we won't hesitate to remove any content that violates our community standards. According to the World Wildlife Fund, Africa lost 110,000 elephants from 2007 until 2015 due to an epidemic of poaching. That's it for our show. You can always follow me on Twitter. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.